Good morning, Your Honors. May I please support? My name is William McCardle. I'm the attorney for American Pizza and Pasta, Inc. and Amarjeet Sandhu, whom I will refer to collectively as Pizza Mart. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please. I'll give my apologies first. I came down with a sinus infection this last weekend, so I'm on heavy meds and a little bit loopy and lightheaded, and these benches look awfully comfortable to curl up and sleep on. So. But in any event, Your Honors, this case concerns the interpretation of several clauses in a lease between Pizza Mart and Children's Hospital. Primary issue is whether Pizza Mart should be permitted to exercise its lease option to extend the lease. The lease states that the tenant may exercise its options unless it has twice within any 12-month period been in default beyond any applicable cure period. And that's some of the key languages, beyond any applicable cure period. And as that language suggests, if you go to the remedies section and the default section, there are different types of problems that have different cure periods. One is a 3-day cure period, and that is for monetary issues. Then there's a 15-day cure period for non-monetary lease issues. And then there's also some flexible language in case it's something that might take longer than 15 days to get dealt with.
And so then, the court here relied on the 3-day cure period?
Yes, the court did adopt a 3-day cure period.
And that was because of the – were there two letters or three?
Two letters.
Because of the two letters about not being current in payments?
Well, the two letters actually were addressing prospective issues. That these are things about what the rent should be going forward rather than making any demand for a past due amount of rent, or other charges. They don't set any deadline for some sort of monetary amount to be paid by. And, you know, they don't in any way qualify as putting a tenant on notice that there is a specific amount of money that needs to be paid in order to prevent his lease from being terminated.
Wouldn't a reasonable person reading those two letters conclude that the author of each intended to communicate you haven't paid some money you owe?
I mean, they do communicate that in one case that Children's had failed to charge an increase, a cost of living type of increase, I believe, but internal memos of Children's said that they were waiving that, and so they really were just notifying Mr. Pizza Mart that going forward your rent will be X dollars per month, and they didn't make any demand for the past due; they just waived that. Now,
so your position is the court erred in concluding that the 3-day cure period applied, and so what's your position, that the 15-day period should have applied?
No, my argument is that the court erred by saying that the 3-day cure period applied, but that it applied without any sort of written notice to the tenant from the landlord.
And that's because you're taking the position that those two letters that Judge Leach just referred to did not meet the requirements of the lease.
Well, I can't say I know exactly why the court ruled that way. I don't
know. No, I'm asking what your position is.
Oh, well, yes, I believe that those letters were inadequate to constitute.
Well, you're basically saying that these letters never triggered the start of any cure period.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yeah, that they don't say that you have to pay something within a certain period of time. They don't state that even a dollar amount. They're just talking about future rent that needs to get paid properly.
So that's your position about why the court erred in granting summary judgment?
Well, I think to bore down a little bit closer, it's that the court said that 3-day window would start secretly, is what I call it, without any kind of notification coming in writing from the landlord.
Well, separate and apart from what you think the court ruled,
right,
I'm trying to hone in on your position.
Right.
And so your position is the court erred in granting summary judgment because it concluded that the 3-day cure period was triggered. And you say, no, that's wrong.
That's true, Your Honor.
Is that the nub of what we've got here?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay.
And I would say that the language of 22-1A, I believe, is very clear that it takes a written notice to start the running of that 3 days. I think that you really have to, like, toss this language into a blender and hit puree and then pour it out and rearrange it in order to say that this 3 days starts immediately after the first of the month. I mean, for instance, the lease in paragraph or section 4 provides for a 5-day grace period before you even incur a late charge of $187. So the way the trial court ruled is that this lease would go into default without any notice from the landlord to say, hey, you're behind in rent for, say, let me just lay a fact pattern. Say the tenant doesn't pay the rent on December 1st. December 4th comes and goes and the rent is not paid. This trial court would say that you didn't have to issue any notification, that 3 days runs without notice is what the court specifically ruled. And that
isn't quite what it ruled. It said that this landlord sent you two letters. Your quibble is whether the text of the letters is sufficient to trigger a cure period. And what the lease provision says, that unless such failure is not cured within 3 days after written notice thereof, and it's referencing default. So the lease requires notice of a default in writing. That's all it requires, though.
Right.
And each of these letters said you hadn't paid money, your client, hadn't paid money that was owed.
Right.
Isn't that notice of a default?
Well, no. I mean, what that paragraph says is that the landlord has to send to the tenant notice of a failure to pay. And it has to be specific as to...
No, it doesn't say that. It says, landlord shall not take action based on such default unless such failure is not cured within 3 days after written notice thereof referring to default. So before you can do anything about a default and paying rent, you have to tell somebody they've defaulted.
Right. And they did not send a notice that told my client that, hey, you have not paid a certain amount of rent and that you need to pay this or else.
They just said you hadn't paid rent for 3 months without any numbers.
Well, that would indicate to me, I mean, if that would be adopted, then they could just send it at the beginning of the lease and say, okay, we've covered our notice requirements under the lease. You can't do that. So anyway, I'm past my time.
Thank you. I see you again in 10 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Kaplow. I'm the attorney for Seattle Children's Hospital. As you know, there were cross motions filed in this case. The operative motion is the motion by Seattle Children's that addressed the issue of whether undisputed payment defaults precluded Pizza Mart from exercising its extension option. And we have identified three independent grounds to uphold the trial court's ruling. The first of which was the subject of most of your discussion, was the written notice requirement. The second is whether or not written default notices were required. And the third is the provision that provides that the failure to pay late charges is deemed a monetary default under the lease. So one and I...
Did the trial court parse out, did it accept all of those arguments, or did it parse out in its ruling?
My sense of the court's ruling was that it focused on the second issue, that it distinguished between what I call little d default, in other words, default written with a small d, and an event of default, which is a defined term. That seemed to be the focus of the ruling on that particular issue, and that it denied the cross motion for summary judgment. So what you've been talking about is the first issue, which is the written notices that were sent, the two written notices. And as you heard, there's criticism of the content of those notices. In other words, whether they were sufficient under the lease to notify the tenant of the default. And as Judge Leach pointed out, the language of the lease itself simply requires that the tenant be notified that there's a default under the lease. And if you look at these two letters, both of them do more than that. They specifically, if you look at the first letter, the March 25 letter, it tells the tenant what the rent is that is being paid and has been paid over the last 3 years, and says you should have increased your payment amount per the lease agreement over the last 3 years. And then it tells them what the amount of the additional rent is and tells them that they need to come into compliance with the lease.
And it gives a date, doesn't it?
And it gives them a date. That's right. And it tells them they're going to be subject to late charges. And then if you look at the second letter, it incorporates the first one by reference, refers to the rental underpayment. It references paying the correct rent amount immediately. It tells them they're going to be in default, and again gives them a date to pay. So none of this is even required. It goes well beyond what I think is required by the lease, but it even meets, I think, the stricter standard that the tenant is now suggesting you impose. In other words, not only do the notices themselves advise the tenant of a default, but it also provides information about the amount of underpayment. It calculates that amount, tells when it should be paid, and indicates the consequences.
Well, the appellant seems to be arguing that there's a problem because there's not consideration of the 5-day grace period. What's your response to that?
I think that's with reference to the second argument, if I understand his argument correctly. In other words, this issue of whether when you're interpreting 51.2, the extension option, so if you look at that provision addresses what I call that little d default, right? It doesn't actually require a event of default. And what counsel, as I understand, is arguing is you need to then go back to the event of default language and look, you're trying to reference what the cure period is there, and he's saying that you need to fulfill all of the requirements of an event of default in order to satisfy the requirements for a little d default that is provided for under the extension option.
So if I'm following this, event of default requires a notice. Little d default doesn't require a notice, just a failure to comply with a provision of the lease. In your reading, 51.2, to use the second definition of default, and that's the one you think that the trial court adopted in its ruling.
That seemed to be the primary basis of the trial
court. But we look at this de novo. So
you do look at it de novo.
So we don't have to if we decided that the two letters complied with the 3-day cure period, we don't reach any of the other.
That's exactly right. All of these arguments stand independently and are in the alternative. So you could either find that the two written notices were issued, you could find that it was not necessary to send written notices because of the structure of the extension option, or you could find that the failure to make the late payments is deemed an event of default, and that would also be a basis to affirm. So those are the three independent grounds. And I think in looking at this, it gets a little bit complicated. It's sort of alphabet soup. But if you look at 22.6, you see that that is an additional remedy provision. This is, again, going to that second argument.
Mm-hmm.
There's the lease specifically provides one set of remedies for events of default, and it provides another additional set of remedies for little d defaults. So the lease is consistently making that distinction between the two in terms of defining little d defaults and defining events of default defining the remedies for events of default, defining the remedies for little d defaults.
So if we found that or concluded that Children's met the requirement for the three-day cure period, then we would affirm the court's decision that the tenant was not entitled to the extension.
Yeah, there's no dispute here that the tenant failed to make payments when due. And in fact, that occurred for over a year, over an 18-month period in 2010 and extending it to 2011. So it goes well beyond 3 days. It's more like 18 months. It's really just whether or not, on that first argument, there's a dispute, as I say, over whether or not the tenant was advised that they were in default. And I don't think there's any serious dispute.
So if they were in default, we don't have to get into this little d, big d.
You don't. No, you.
We don't have to parse the defaults?
You don't. The trial court and I had a interesting discussion about that, and so did Mr. McArdle. But there is a simpler solution to this.
Okay.
So I have a question. Is it your position that the November 26th letter triggered 22.6 because it talked about the number of times being in which there had been a failure to pay an amount due and required it all to get paid?
Yes, the landlord would have been entitled to additional security under 22.6 because there had been three periods of underpayment by November. In fact, there had been well over that. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, one of the issues that I took issue with the trial court's ruling was that the trial court ruled that there was no notice required in order to trigger the running of the 3 days. And I believe that flies.
Well, and I think that's the little d argument.
Well,
which you all had a long conversation about
in
the trial court.
That was kind of a new one on me at the trial court ruling that, we're distinguished between little d and big d. I don't see any distinction in the trial court or in the lease between a small default.
Let's assume
and
there's
big
no
default.
Distinction.
Yeah.
How do you avoid the consequences of 22.6?
Well, 22.6 allows the landlord to insist upon some prepayment of the rent if there was multiple failures to pay the rent.
Well, it also appears to contemplate that there could have been two defaults without any notices.
Right.
Before that request.
Yeah. Well, I would say that the lease is not perfectly consistent in how it treats the term default. In reading 22.1A, the language says that there has to be a three-day cure period.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to relate back to Section 51 that deals with the options to extend the lease, that there has to be a default plus the applicable cure period. And these two notices that we focused on, Exhibits F and G,
right,
they don't say you need to pay X or else you're in default. They are no such thing. They are
Just kind of walk through this.
Sure.
Your client acknowledges getting the March 25th, 2010 letter.
Correct. Not in the manner that it was.
Let's not fight about that right now.
All
his
right.
Time's running out. And it told him to pay $4,046.71 a month after that, right?
Correct.
And he didn't do that, did he?
Well, it wasn't saying
that's yes or no either. He did it or he didn't do it.
Well, he did pay the rent.
He didn't pay it on the. This says when it's due. He didn't pay it on the first day of each month when it was due, did he?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And so that. Your client then at that point had notice that he was in default and he continued to default. And then in November 26th, you were told your client's defaulted a whole bunch of times. Now let's get this cleared up.
Yeah.
And your client didn't clear it up then either, did he?
Well, there were various lease issues going on that were of a non-monetary matter.
But he didn't clear up the undisputed monetary ones.
Well, when Children's did issue a 3-day notice to pay or vacate, my client did pay up within that period of time.
So it took an eviction threat not just a notice to get money.
It took a three-day notice to cure, pay or vacate, that would be consistent with the requirements of 22-1A.
Well, 22-1A just says notice. It doesn't say pay or quit.
It doesn't say pay or quit. That's correct. But it says...
Your time's up.
All right. Okay.
Thanks so much. Court's in recess.
Court is now in recess.